Now, what about Dagny Taggart? In my lecture, I want to first ask, who is Dagny? To see this, we'll need to fill in some of the backstory that the movie wasn't able to present in full. This backstory helps us understand better the meaning of the events in the movie. To better appreciate Dagny and the way of life she represents, we'll go on to look more closely at three big themes in her life: her independent thinking, her experience of business and technology as an exalted artistic experience, and her intransigent dedication to her values. These themes provide us with a model of how to live a dynamic, flourishing modern life. And finally, we'll see how Dagny's love of life cashes out in her love life itself. In this webinar, I'm going to be taking the character of Dagny Taggart, as portrayed by Taylor Schilling in the movie Atlas Shrugged Part 1, as my baseline. And I'm bringing in information from the novel to explain and enrich our understanding of this heroic woman. We can do this because the movie is exceptionally well integrated with the novel. Very little in the movie contradicts the novel in spirit, and many of the scenes and lines directly match to events in the novel. And knowing the novel makes a lot of what's happening in the movie much more comprehensible. But before I go on, I thought I would ask how many of you all have seen the movie or read the novel. I'm going to open up a poll here. Just click on the answer that represents your situation. So, there's the poll. Which is showing okay, well, I see that the majority of you all have both read the novel and seen the movie, but I'll try to do this in a way that is I'm really had originally aimed this at people that had mainly seen the movie, but well, hopefully this will be a fun ride through a story we all love a lot. So I hope that'll be enjoyable for everyone. Okay, I'm going to close the poll so I can get back to showing you the rest of my screen. Okay, so who is Dagny Taggart? So who is Dagny Taggart? I'd like to begin with the way she's portrayed in the movie. The Dagny we see in the movie is a beautiful and stylish woman. We first meet her in her elegant penthouse apartment. We almost never see her out of high heels or in any kind of casual clothing. She has a cold, rather emotionless way of speaking most of the time. She speaks clearly and logically. She's a business executive, and we see her in chauffeured limousines and in the halls and offices of the clean, modern towers of Taggart Transcontinental. As vice president in charge of operations of a national railroad, we see her discussing train routes with her brother James, the railroad CEO, and negotiating business arrangements with men in suits. This is true to Ayn Rand's portrait of Dagny, but it doesn't show us the whole person. It's not that the Dagny of the novel is ugly or frumpy. She's vice president in charge of operation. She does hold meetings with men in business suits. In fact, practically every business conversation she has in the movie is taken from the novel. In the novel, she talks facts and figures with an almost religious intensity. She takes money-making, really earning money, as a high calling. But what the novel shows us that the movie simply does not is Dagny's inner life. In the novel, we don't meet Dagny in her elegant penthouse, although she has one. We meet her instead anonymously as a nondescript woman in an ordinary train car hearing a symphony in her head. So I want to take you to the moment in the novel when Dagny is introduced. Ayn Rand writes, "She sat at the window of the train, her head thrown back, one leg stretched across the empty seat before her." And then I leave out a little bit, pick it back up. "She kept her hands in her pockets, her posture taut, as if she resented immobility, and unfeminine, as if she were unconscious of her own body and that it was a woman's body. She sat listening to the music. It was a symphony of triumph. The notes slowed up, and they spoke of rising, and they were rising itself. They seemed to embody every human act and thought that had ascent as its motive. She thought, for just a few moments, while this lasts, it is all right to surrender completely, to forget everything, to just permit yourself to feel. She thought, let go, drop the controls. This is it." Somewhere on the edge of her mind, under the music, she heard the sound of train wheels. They knocked in an even rhythm, every fourth knock accented, as if stressing a conscious purpose. She could relax because she heard the wheels. She listened to the symphony, thinking, this is why the wheels have to be kept going. This is where they're going. A bit later, when the train stops for no reason, and Dagny steps forward to resolve the crisis, we first learn her name. As she walks back to her train car, we hear a young brakeman ask, "Who is that?" "That's who really runs Taggart Transcontinental," said the engineer. The respect in his voice was genuine. "That's the vice president in charge of operation." Ayn Rand has introduced us to Dagny through what Dagny feels, thinks, and does. We see her first as a woman with a rich inner life, a woman who feels that human aspirations, great art, and technology are all of a piece, a woman who is taught with controls, but who's rich in inner feeling. Only then do we learn that she's the vice president in charge of operation, and we learn it through the fact that she's the one who can take charge of the stopped train and straighten out the workers' confusion. We can see by their reaction to her that she's a doer, that she's earned her place, and that her place is on the railroad, not just sitting in some office. Indeed, because Ayn Rand is at pains to show the economy that Dagny lives in, she's at pains to show the economy that Dagny lives in and to show that it's falling apart. Dagny's carefully selected apartment, with its glorious view of the city's skyscrapers, is not a standard upper-crust dwelling, as it is in the movie, but it's an intensely personal shout of defiance against a crumbling world. In the movie, when Dagny answers Eddie Willers's first phone call, it's morning in her darkened apartment. Excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. Okay, I'm back. As I was saying, in the movie, when Dagny answers Eddie Willers' first phone call, it's morning in her darkened apartment, and she opens the blinds out onto what would strike us as a glorious image of the best of modern life. But instead, in the movie, she appears to be just letting in the morning light. In the context of the novel, we can see that her view is something exceptional, something that reflects the symphonies to civilization that play in her heart. So who is Dagny Taggart? Her own woman, most of all. In the movie, we have no sense of how James Taggart and Dagny Taggart came to the positions they hold. We can see that there's little love lost between them, but we don't know why. they were born into privilege, scions of an industrial empire founded by their grandfather, Nathaniel Taggart. Nathaniel Taggart was a man who rose by his own merit and refused all government favors. When they were children, they had the model of Nat Taggart before them. James, for his part, assumed that he would hold power due to his position of birth. He did not need to earn what was granted to him. Dagny was the girl and was not expected to work on the railroad. Rand writes, Dagny Taggart was 9 years old when she decided she would run the Taggart Transcontinental Railroad one day. She stated it to herself when she stood alone between the rails, looking at two straight lines of steel that went off to the distance and met in a single point. She was 15 when it occurred to her for the first time that women did not run railroads and that other people might object. To hell with that, she thought, and never worried about it again. Now, Eddie Willers and Dagny Taggart were childhood friends. They had another friend who was also the heir to a great industrial fortune. This was the brilliant, dashing Francisco D'Anconia, the Argentinian copper magnate's son. Francisco and Dagny both understood that it was ability that was required to run a great business enterprise. They understood that the only person worthy to inherit a business is one who doesn't need to inherit it, one who could build the business anew by his own effort if he had to. This is what we see. This is what we do not see clearly in the movie. We see that Dagny can run the railroad. The construction of the John Galt line is meant to show that she could build one too. Rand makes Dagny's willingness to work and her ability to do so plain in recounting her early career, something that we don't see in the movie. So understanding this helps us better understand how Dagny ended up where she did. Rand writes, she went to work for Taggart Transcontinental at the age of 16. Her father permitted it. He was amused and a little curious. She started as a night operator at a small country station. She had to work nights for the first few years while attending a college of engineering. James Taggart began his career on the railroad at the same time. He was 21. He started in the Department of Public Relations. Dagny's rise among the men who operated Taggart Transcontinental was swift and uncontested. She took positions of responsibility because there was no one else to take them. Her superiors, who held the authority, seemed afraid to exercise it. They spent their time avoiding decisions, so she told people what to do, and they did it. At every step of her rise, she did the work long before she was granted the title. That's Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. Thus, Dagny is not a wealthy heir who happens to be in business. She's a dedicated businesswoman who is supremely competent and who happens to be an heir. Now, who is Dagny Taggart at the moment we meet her in the Atlas Shrugged, the movie? She's a woman characterized from childhood by independent thinking. She's a woman for whom a business enterprise, a railroad, is like a symphony. She's a woman who chooses what she values and then dedicates herself to achieving it. Let's discuss each of these traits in turn. First, independent thinking. Ayn Rand described the virtue of independence, that is, the principle of independent thinking, in the climactic speech of Atlas Shrugged. She wrote, independence is the recognition of the fact that yours is the responsibility of judgment, and nothing can help you escape it, that no substitute can do your thinking, as no pinch hitter can live your life. We see this principle at work in the first conversation we see between Dagny and her brother Jim, one that is well represented, that is actually well represented in the movie. They're debating whether or not to use Riordan metal, the new alloy that hasn't been used for any other major industrial project. Jim kicks off the conversation here. The consensus of the best metallurgical authorities, he said, seems to be highly skeptical about Reardon metal, contending, drop it, Jim. Well, whose opinions do you take? I don't ask for opinions. What do you go by? Judgment. Well, whose judgment do you take? Mine. But who says so? Jim, I studied engineering in college. When I see them, when I see things, I see them. Excuse me, there's a slight typo on my slide. When I see things, I see them. Now, Dagny here, in this conversation, we actually see some of the key elements of Ayn Rand's view of independent thinking represented in Dagny. So the keys to independent thinking include the importance of judging a fact versus the importance of recognizing judgments of fact, which are judgments about the way the world is, rather than opinions that are fundamentally statements of belief, that are statements about the way one is mentally inclined. Now, one ought to believe in the truth. One ought to believe in one's judgments of fact. But which is more important, that one believes or that one has made an accurate judgment of fact? For Dagny, it's judgment, not opinions. Another key point here is that each person forms their own knowledge. For Dagny, there is no other answer about why to use Reardon metal than that she judged that it was best. Ultimately, each person has to form their own knowledge. And so when we get information from other people, when we hear from the metallurgical experts, when we look at the data that other people have represented, when we hear their arguments, we have to relate the information that they provide us to the things that we know directly, the things that we've come to understand, the things that we can confirm in our own experience. And thus, for independent thinking, objectivity is key. It's key to recognize that knowledge is about the facts, and that the point is to get the facts without fear or favor. To keeping an independent frame of mind means keeping a focus on the facts and not letting other people's statements or opinions trump what you know precisely. And in this context, Dagny consistently uses the language of it is. She will say that something is, that it does work, that it is good or it is bad, because that is an expression of her judgment of what it is. Whereas Jim speaks in terms of what things seem to be, or what someone seems to be saying, or what someone else's opinion is, which are weasel terms that let him avoid having to say directly. Now, of course, in reality, there's times when you need to speak about what is, and there's times when you have to speak about what seems to be because you're not quite sure what the real situation is. There's nothing wrong with being uncertain when you are uncertain and discussing based on your uncertainty. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. But what is wrong is substituting uncertainty when there is a need for certainty, or when one are equating uncertainty with certainty. The contrast between Dagny and James on these issues is present everywhere they appear in the novel. James evades making decisions. His first words in the novel are, "Don't bother me, don't bother me, don't bother me." Dagny, for her part, makes decisions. James looks to the opinions of others for his ethics, his facts, his self-esteem. Dagny bases her judgment on the facts and her independent judgment. And thus, when she esteems the opinion of someone else, when she esteems the judgment, she's really esteeming their judgment. And she's respecting them based on what she knows about their own rational capacities. But for Dagny, knowledge is never an end in itself. Throughout both the movie and the novel, we see her seeking knowledge only for the sake of putting it to use? And where is it put to use in the noblest of human endeavors, the creation of value? It is the productive creation that drives, that unites the symphony composer and the baker of daily bread. In Dagny Taggart, Ayn Rand shows us a woman completely committed to business as the means of realizing all that is best in herself. We see this in part one, most of all, in her decision to build the John Galt line independently. Taggart Transcontinental has been battered financially by Jim Taggart's strategic blunders. Public attacks on Reardon Metal have decreased public confidence in Dagny's project to rebuild the Rio Norte line with that new alloy. Taggart Transcontinental stock is collapsing. But Dagny is confident in her judgment that Reardon Metal is by far the best material for railroads. Her solution is to take the John Galt line private. She lines up financing not from the public in general, but from specific individuals who can make objective, independent judgments. We see in the building of the John Galt line what Dagny is really made of and how capable she is. We see the truth in the observation that it is she and Hank Reardon who move the world, that they're the Atlases who are carrying the world on their shoulders. Before Dagny goes to board the first run on the new Reardon Metal John Galt line, she meets the press. This is something that's represented only sketchily in the movie, but is detailed in one of my favorite scenes in the novel. Dagny isn't inclined to meet the press, so this is somewhat exception-making on her part. And she gets up before the press and simply reads them all the figures about the line, about why it will work, and about how low its costs are, and how much money she expects to make. She fends off a few misguided questions, and then she says that she'll offer a quote for the press. And it is, Miss Taggart says, quote, I expect to make a pile of money on the John Galt line. I will have earned it, close quote. That's the justice of business under free enterprise. It's the creation of value. And profits, if earned through honest trade, are all earned and deserved. But more than the meaning of the finances of her line, the John Galt line represents the importance of practical knowledge and the meaning of industry and technology in human life. Ayn Rand, through the eyes of Dagny, offers us a searing critique of the standard cultural view that treats mechanisms and machines and technologies as low material creations and that exalts the emotional and the spiritual apart from those things, that aims for knowledge without any purpose behind it. For Rand, there's a unity of theory and practice. There's a unity of creative activity beyond the creation of technologies. And when we see a technology, we're seeing human intelligence in action. And during the stirring run of the John Galt line in the novel, in a point that I really wish had come through clearly in the movie, but I don't think it does, Rand has Dagny walking back through the motor section of the locomotive that's pulling the John Galt line train and feeling the motors and their force and looking at them and thinking about what they mean. And in an extended passage, there's this key quote here from Rand. Speaking of Dagny, Rand writes, why had she always felt the joyous sense of confidence when looking at machines, she thought. In these giant shapes, two aspects pertaining to the inhuman were radiantly absent, the causeless and the purposeless. Every part of the motors was an embodied answer to why and what for, like the steps of a life course chosen by the sort of mind she worshipped. The motors were a moral code cast in steel. They are alive, she thought, because they are the physical shape of the action of a living power, of the mind that had been able to grasp the whole of this complexity, to set its purpose, to give it form. This is a brilliant passage in Rand where she calls us to look out at the world and see how every automobile, every computer, every tool, every machine we see has a human intelligence and purpose behind it. It was created for a reason. It was designed by a mind. It's, in fact, a frozen intelligence put forward so that a person can use it. Today, in the age of computers, we're used to thinking of intelligence being embodied in machines through software, which are written in a software which is written in something like language. But Rand's point is much more general and really asks us to look out and see a world in which a human purpose and human creativity are flourishing all around us all the time. And this is something that is a bedrock appreciation in Dagny's life. It's part of how Dagny views the world, and it helps explain a great deal of everything else that Dagny does in her life. It's understanding this fact. So Dagny has an appreciation for what business is and what technology are. She sees them as a kind of symphony running through all of our civilization, a symphony of value creation and of human purpose, of good things happening. But one of the characteristics that Dagny also has that's very important to the plot of the whole novel is that Dagny is a person who is absolutely committed to her values. She's absolutely committed to the things that she cares about and that she wants in life. One of those things that she loves most in life is the Taggart Transcontinental Railroad itself. This is something she chose at a very young age as the thing that she wanted to run and preserve and help flourish. And then she loves the railroad, and she'll fight with everything she has to keep it alive. In the movie, we see that John Galt is going around talking to the different business people and convincing them to go on strike. And he gets close to Dagny at one point, but it's going to be a tough sell to try and sell Dagny on going on strike, because Dagny is committed to the railroad as a basic value in her life. It's something she loves and something she wants to preserve. The basic theme about value dedication, which runs through Dagny's choice of her lovers, it runs through her choice of her apartment with its a beautiful view, it runs through her choice of practical clothing, it runs through the way she operates, this total commitment to value is founded on the basic principle that value is personal. And we see this very clearly when Dagny offers to trade her diamond necklace for the Reardon metal bracelet that Lillian Reardon has been given by her husband. In this moment, Dagny is focused on what she really values, what she cares about. She sees the bracelet and knows what it represents. She knows that she values it much more than she values any ordinary diamond necklace, both for its preciousness, for its unique historical significance as the first pour of Reardon metal, for what Reardon metal represents, which she understands and few people do, her admiration for Hank Reardon, her frustration with Lillian and for being so contemptuous of Reardon and his achievements. And so when she offers to trade her necklace for the bracelet, taking Lillian up on her words, she's expressing her fundamental personal values and expressing actually the real love she has for Reardon and his works. The point here is not that the Tagger Transcontinental Railroad or the bracelet are the best for everyone, but they're the best for Dagny, and she'll have nothing less. And that's the takeaway message for all of us, is that value is personal, and it has to be preserved. Now, I just want to wrap up with a short commentary about how Dagny's value attitude and her background cash out in, or how we can better understand her love life as it's represented. In the movie, we see that Dagny and Francisco D'Anconia have something going on. We're told that he's her ex-lover, and we can see that he still appreciates her, but there's this big misunderstanding, and she can't understand what's happened to him. In the novel, this is rendered even more poignant because after a brief introduction of Francisco as a playboy, we have the whole backstory of his life as a supremely capable young man, as the childhood friend of Dagny and later her lover when they were teenagers, people committed to competence, committed to a rational view of life, committed to enjoying everything that their minds and bodies can bring them in life. And then Francisco went away to college and went off into the business world and after a while and lost touch with her and told her that she might not understand what he was next going to do. And then next thing she knows, he's this useless playboy, as far as she can tell. So in the novel, the heartbreak that Dagny feels about Francisco is much more poignant because we have this backstory. And actually, we see more clearly that Dagny has a deep emotional conflict with respect to Francisco because she's still attracted to him, even though she doesn't respect him intellectually. The novel also has a deep theme in Dagny's relationship with Hank Reardon that doesn't get represented much in the movie. It's one I'll return to in my webinar next week on Hank Reardon. But here we see the scene after the first run of the John Galt line, when Dagny and Reardon first share their first kiss. At this moment, Reardon feels guilty for betraying his marriage vows and his ideal of womanhood in Dagny. But Dagny feels nothing like guilt here, because in Reardon and in loving him, she's expressing her commitment to her values and to the fundamental things she respects. And because she's learned, she's learned through working with him on the John Galt line about who he really is and what he really represents. So she replies to him saying this: "You may dispose of me as you please. I'm not afraid to admit it. I have nothing to protect from you and nothing to reserve. You think that this is a threat to your achievement, but it's not to mine. I will sit at my desk and work, and when things around me get hard to bear, I will think that for my reward, I will be in your bed that night. Did you call it depravity? I'm much more depraved than you are. You hold it as your guilt, and I as my pride. I'm more proud of it than anything I've done, more proud than of building the line. If I'm asked to name my proudest attainment, I will say, I have slept with Hank Reardon. I will have earned it." So we can see Dagny's attitude to her relationship with Reardon. She doesn't feel guilty about the fact that he's a married man because she sees and knows how hollow his marriage is and how unvalued he is by his wife. That Lillian doesn't value Hank and doesn't love him. And so she doesn't feel like she's asking him to betray anything real that he has with Lillian. This is something that Hank doesn't understand. And for Dagny, her love of Hank brings together her feelings and her emotional side with her business and her scientific judgment and their ongoing collaborations in searching for the motor at the 20th Century Motor Company, in supporting each other through the various struggles they're having and are going to have with the growing statism in the society, represents a fundamental ideal of unity of mind and body, of loving someone you esteem, of independence of mind, setting aside convention. When convention and the conventional definition of marriage doesn't fit the situation, and showing total commitment to the things that you really value. Dagny, once she realizes what Reardon represents to her and what a unique relationship she has with him, is willing to go all in on that relationship because that's her attitude towards her values, which is to go all in. So we come away with a portrait of Dagny as a woman who loves life, who loves the real life we actually live in, who lives in a symphony of value and creation, who expresses her values directly, who acts based on her own judgment, and who commits herself completely to the values that make her happy and give her life meaning. And that's an expression of love of life that I think we all could learn from. Now, I've come to the end of my prepared remarks, so please feel free to join into the interaction of the webinar by asking questions and letting us know what you're thinking of. You can write questions, or you can just note that you want to speak in the question and answer question section, or you can raise your hand using the raise your hand tool to let me call on you. I don't see any hands raised at the moment, and I've got just a couple questions here from people, but I'll try and answer them. I'll just take as many questions as there are, and we can have a nice discussion. Steve Billow writes in saying, Dagny contends that she's qualified to make a decision just because she studied engineering. We know today that there are millions of bad, irrational engineers, and that an engineering degree does not make you automatically intelligent. In the book, that's okay, because we know a lot about Dagny. In the movie, it seems laughable. Why do you think the movie avoided explaining who Dagny really is, and why that is a valid statement? Well, I can't speak to why the movie makers did something or didn't it, and why they made the exact choices they did on certain lines, because I just don't have that information, and I didn't write the screenplay, so I don't know exactly why. I mean, you can infer that the scene in the movie is there in an attempt to provide in a very condensed way what's represented in the novel. Of course, it seems the part of the issue is, I think, that the line, I studied engineering in college, is a line that sounded a lot more technically sophisticated in the 1950s than it does today because of the explosion of university education since that time. So the value of Dagny's engineering degree would be appreciated differently today. And sure, there's a question whether BS in engineering would be sufficient to make you able to understand a complex chemical process. But the basic basic nature of Dagny's answer here is that she has sufficient technical ability to assess the data, and that she's observed the metal in laboratory testing or in lab results. And so she has a firsthand judgment that she thinks she's qualified to make and that is sound in this case. So I agree that the scene in the movie can seem laughable to some people. I've listened to some critics talking about the movie, sort of left liberal bien pensants. The Slate magazine had a chat about the movie where they kind of snarked about it for 15 minutes. But it was interesting to listen to these, smart journalists snark, because it gives you a whole grasp of how their worldview differs from the worldview that Rand's trying to portray, and how even they just don't get it. They really just don't get it. But the point is that one of the things they snarked about was the idea that Jim appeals to all the metallurgical authorities and Dagny just ignores that, right? And there's a context here that probably needed to be explained more clearly, which is that Jim is citing a bunch of vague opinions and their sort of junk arguments, but Dagny has actually dealt with the real data and has formed a judgment based on science, and that's the distinction that's being drawn here. By the way, let me put in a plug here. Soon on our website, we will have a section called Myths of Ayn Rand, where we will have links to prominent commentators who just get Rand completely wrong, where we'll have some short essays where we give some examples of common ways people get Rand wrong, and then we show how you should get Rand right. So check that out when it's up on our website. Should be up any day now. Phil Coates writes in asking, could the sequels to the movie flesh out certain specific things better in your view? Oh, sure they could. This movie could have fleshed out things better. I think the movie's a good movie, basically. I think it was treated unnecessarily harshly. It actually got the standard treatment Ayn Rand has gotten in practically all of her work from the critics, and perhaps because the movie is a solid and good movie, but not a piece of cinematic genius qua movie, it's less able than Rand was in her novel writing to just overwhelm the critics with the quality and appeal of her work. But so let me say, yes, of course, this movie could have been better in this respect, and the future ones could. I'm hopeful. Well, I'd like to see the screenwriters and the director and producers take the trouble to bring out certain deeper themes that the characters represent. I don't see how you do part two of the novel without Reardon's guilt and his contradiction between his duty ethic and his desires. Between his ideal of a non-physical knowledge and virtue with his physical lust for Dagny. And I think to have meat in the second part, you're going to have to go into that, and you're going to have to then go to the issue of mind-body unity and talk about that. So I don't know. What more could be said about that? I'm getting lots of questions here. That's wonderful. Thanks, you all. Just a second. Sean Colonna writes in asking, could I elaborate on the difference between opinion and fact? Can we have opinions about facts? Are opinions supported by facts more quote-unquote valid? I was drawing a distinction between opinion and judgment. Let me get that slide back up here. Okay. Opinion versus judgment. The point is here, this is a point that David Kelly discusses in some detail in some of his essays on epistemology. It's a very good point. There's a traditional distinction in epistemology, in the theory of knowledge, between or a definition of knowledge as justified true belief. So it's belief because you assent mentally to its being true. It's justified by the facts that make it true, and it's true based it's justified by the arguments that make it true, and it's true because of its relationship to the facts. Now, in the objectivist view, knowledge is a form of awareness of facts. It's not fundamentally a kind of belief. When you have knowledge, you're aware of the facts about something, so that you know that I'm William R. Thomas, for example. You've got my picture in front of you. You've got you can look me up on our website. I'm talking to you right now, and that's a fact. That you know it is that it is true is based on me actually being William R. Thomas. Your knowing it puts you in a position of awareness and of knowing something that's really going on in the world that then allows you to respond to it. Now, when you know something, you may believe it, and you should believe it, but belief is your inclination to agree that something's true. It's a little switch you toggle in your mind where you say, I will regard this as true, and there's a big problem in society generally when people emphasize belief over knowledge. And this cashes out in the distinction between judgment and opinion. In the newspapers, for example, there's a difference between the opinion pages and the fact journalism pages. And the idea is, I guess, on the opinion pages, you don't have to say anything true. Or what? The point is here that what objectivism argues for, what Rand argues for, and what she's representing in Dagny's behavior and her relations with Jim is she's arguing for having your focus be on what the judgment of fact is. What's the thing about which you're aware? What have you become aware of? What do you know? Rather than how are you inclined to feel about it, which is what saying someone has someone expressed an opinion. An opinion is a point of view. There's plenty of point of views that people can create about anything. I can give you, there's point of views about the death of Osama bin Laden. It was a great thing. It was a terrible thing. It was a so-so thing. You can give all sorts of views. You could have all sorts of opinions, but what is the fact of the matter? What's the judgment of the situation? That's what really matters. So please follow up with me if you've got a further question. I've got a question here from Justin Groover. See, you're still here, Justin. Justin writes in saying, for me, two scenes in the film that dramatized the contrast of Dagny and James's intellectual independence were, A, the sight of Dagny and Hank taking visible delight in the use of their minds when coming upon the blueprints of the motor and extrapolating the possibilities, and B, James being geared toward the familiar and undemanding, i.e., his playing with an electric train. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that was represented, and I think there were various moments in the movie that represent the intellectual independence of the heroes and show James as intellectually dependent. I have a little quibble about the screenplay, however. There's a scene where James is meeting with the political cabal of Orrin Boyle and Wesley Mauch, and I think Philip Larkin's there too, and they're discussing their various plots, the anti-dog-eat-dog rule and how to bring Reardon down and equalization of opportunity bill, and they see Francisco D'Anconia walk through the bar, and James says something like, he wants to know what's, he's noticed that Francisco's not shipping much of anything out of his Mexican mines. And that's not so like James. What's like James is to say, I'm hearing bad rumors about Francisco's Mexican mines, or I'm wondering about I've been hearing criticisms, or not all the public is behind this project, or what's happened that we the public was behind our investment in Mexico, but now people are asking doubts or raising doubts, and it's hurting our stock price. That would be a opinion mongering thing like James, for James to do. David Peters writes in saying, having read the book many, many times over the years, I was disappointed in Ms. Schilling's bloodless, for the most part, portrayal, almost as if she were reading her lines for a dry run. The exceptions, Dagny's encounter with the union rep, the initial encounter with Ellis Wyatt, and the discovering the motor, almost proved the rule. Even her scenes with her brother were bland, as if she made such threats, promises, on so regular a basis that this was run-of-the-mill. I think Dagny is a very tricky role to play because you've got to communicate a real objectivity, a kind of inner balance, a focus on the facts, a tautness and controlledness to her, but a person with rich inner feeling, without many of the standard forms that you would use. So Dagny isn't very overtly emotional, and she tends to speak in clear, precise terms. So I wasn't as disappointed with Schilling's performance in that respect. I didn't think she always hit it right on the bullseye, but I think she did a creditable job in that regard. But thanks for sharing your view there, David. Phil Coates follows up saying his idea suggestion of the sequels is not less dialogue but more, like the talkies of the 30s and the 40s. Phil, I would like to see some more dialogue in some ways, like, for instance, I wish that there had been 5 or so minutes given to the whole story of the 20th Century Motor Company that would have put all that in much more in context. But I think in the movies, you have to think very hard about showing things rather than telling them. So there has to be a way to show them. Like, perhaps instead of hearing about Francisco's Mexican mines, we could have been shown them. Or I would even advocate cooking up scenes that aren't in the novel in order to show things that would otherwise be talked about. Because talking about things is how you handle them in a novel in a lot of cases, but it's certainly a technique to work the description of a situation into the dialogue of the novel. But in the movies, it works much better if you can show the showing in movies happens through the visual image. And so it's important to have scenes where the visual image tells you what you need to know. 30 seconds of Hank Reardon beating metal or walking along or working on the floor of his steel factory or working in a chemical lab, anything like that, would have done wonders for understanding that Reardon wasn't just a suit-wearing CEO. And likewise, for Dagny, if we see more scenes of her just working top to bottom in Tiger Transcontinental, we would have appreciated her much better. So I would certainly like to see more words. I think it would be possible to make a slightly longer movie, but I would also like to see a more creative use of scenes to show these points that we're bringing out from behind the novel, to show them as much as possible. Ron Bauer writes in asking, how does Dagny justify helping Hank break his marriage vows? He's obviously not officially ended the marriage, so she's helping him break his promise. I think partly this is an aspect of the novel's plot which is dated relative to the present day. So this is before No-Fault Divorce and is before the divorce explosion of the 1970s. So this part of the novel was written for a cultural context that's different. But I think what Rand is Rand's view and Dagny's is that Reardon's promise to, or Reardon's marriage to Lillian is really founded on a love relationship. And if instead of a love relationship, there's a hate and parasitism relationship, then the promise that Lillian made to Hank has long since been broken. And that while there is a legal marriage, in morality and spirituality, it's just not there anymore. And so I think that's the way Dagny sees it. I don't think the point here is that we should betray people we love. That's not it at all. It's that Lillian and Hank haven't had a love relationship even from the first day of their marriage. I'll talk about that next week when I talk about Hank Reardon. So again, Dagny actually leaves Hank to sort out his feelings relative to Lillian on his own, because that's a complex issue for him that he has to work out, his views of duty, etc. Something that doesn't come through clearly in the movie, but hopefully will be grist for part two. Justin Gruber writes in asking, can I cite some modern day equivalents of both Dagny and James? Can I cite some? Well, just off the cuff, I could say when you have a CEO like Ken Lay, who was the head of Enron, who evaded sufficient knowledge about his firm to know whether the books were actually being cooked. I mean, and whose real strength was his Washington connections. You have someone who's much more like James. I think George W. Bush, when he was a businessman involved with the Texas Rangers, is a perfect James Taggart kind of figure. And as for Dagny Taggart type figures, there are numerous heroic entrepreneurs out there. I'd say a person who I've got a couple of my entrepreneurial heroes who I think represent Dagny-ish traits are Steve Jobs and Elon Musk. Musk was one of the founders of PayPal, and he's now owns SpaceX and is behind Tesla Motors, the electric car company, and very committed to his values, very committed to productive invention and creation of value, very focused on trying to find new ways to do things and to bring costs down. Doesn't have an intrinsic value approach, but rather a kind of human-centered ethic, very admirable. And Jobs, who's worked from the creative end, from the birth of the personal computer, all the way through to the present day, with sort of endless creativity and ability to motivate a team of people to really achieve quality products, and a vision of how to make ideas and products work that's happened over and over and over throughout his career. A brilliant example of that, I think. I don't know. No, so those are just a couple examples off the top of my head, but there are plenty more. I mean, you think of any business who's largely depends for its existence on its relations with Washington is likely to be your James Taggart type. And a business that's whose fundamental business model doesn't work that way is going to have trouble having a James Taggart up at the top. Oh, Bill Ford. There's another example of William Clay Ford, the I think he's now chairman of Ford Motor, isn't the CEO anymore. He was a Jim Taggart figure, if there ever was one. Well, so I've just slanged and praised a bunch of people. I don't have time to actually describe what they say. Got a few more questions here. Just going to keep going through them. But I, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to open up my poll about how you liked the webinar, because I'd like to hear from those of you all who might be heading out, because I'm just going to open up this webinar, this poll. Just let me know how you like the webinar, because if you're going to log out soon, I'd like to still like your opinion. Please, if you do log out before we wrap up, you can email me a question or send me your opinion by email. I'd appreciate that. Al Drost writes in saying, is the emphasis on individual judgment in business and innovation in Atlas Shrugged somewhat outdated today? All corporations seem to be led by a group rather than an individual. Even inventions are normally a group effort, such as the Manhattan Project or manned space flight. Well, Ayn Rand's business hero of the 19th century was James J. Hill, and he certainly didn't build his railroad alone. I think it's indubitable that most business projects are done through the cooperation of individuals. And it's indubitable, exactly what you say, that there's group activities. Public corporations exist so that a whole group of people can get together and invest money, and a larger group of people can cooperate in the production of things. And yet, there are no groups that are not groups of individuals. And we see that that in the business world, the right leadership can be extremely valuable. Creative activity often happens at the level of the individual or in small groups of people that trust each other and are sharing information and ideas back and forth. And so I think the message of Atlas Shrugged that civilization itself depends on the efforts of the productive and creative people, and that our technologies represent some of our highest civilizational achievements, and that there's a beauty to our whole free market system based on the fact that there's value being endlessly created and traded, and value concretized and represented in our technologies. That all of that is very much true still today. And I think it's important in a context where we often work in groups to keep prizing our independence and recognizing the value of the individual. Thanks for that question. It's a good question. Marjorie Peters writes in and says, do I think that the critics' reactions, both by the media or by philosophers, might be an emotional gut response to the idea of rational self-interest? I've never understood the underlying hatred they display. Or is it an emotional response to the idea that anyone dares to assert the idea that he is right and the world is wrong on moral issues and how man should live? In a nutshell, I think, Marjorie, what I'm seeing in a lot of the critics is a concrete-bound mentality. So they reach their judgments about the economy by the fact that we have statism and the sky hasn't fallen in. So the free market attitudes of Rand are obviously not so. That the Republicans were in power and or their policies had a lot of influence by the time the economic crisis came. So it must be free market economics is to blame for the current crisis. So that's kind of concrete bound mentality. I think I've observed in some of these critics the total inability to get the vision that Dagny has while she's riding on the John Galt line. They take all our technology for granted. They live in a world where it's kind of dog-eat-dog on the margin, where you're always jockeying for position and you're always benchmarking yourself against other people, and it's all about beating other people to win in the social race rather than flourishing and succeeding in your own life. I've seen things where critics who, from their other criticism, you can see they, Jonathan Chait, writing The New Republic, has been an example of this. I call him out in a couple of the myth essays I've written that'll be going up on our website soon. So Chait, for instance, seems to have the view that the wealthy are horrible people and exploit the workers. Rand said that people should be free to earn wealth. Therefore, Rand thinks the wealthy are all good and she hates the workers. But see, he's imposing his class-based analysis, and it's not Rand's. You know, Rand isn't for the wealthy per se. You know, Jim Taggart is wealthy. So thanks for that question. Jeffrey Borrowdale writes in. Let's see, is Jeffrey still here? Yes. Jeffrey Borrowdale writes in. He says, global warming is a good example how some of the most respected scientific authorities could say one thing, but a thinking person exercising independent judgment could look at the data himself and draw a different conclusion. Having a degree or a background in science helps one see the problems with politically motivated scientific orthodoxy. I think global warming is the science of global warming is a complex issue, and not a lot of people are well qualified to understand the science and the modeling very well. Like a lot of our science, there's a whole downstream process that comes out of a specialized graduate study that's happened in there. I myself am a little skeptical of a lot of the global warming models just because I'm trained in economics, and they look a lot to me like, when I see them described, they look a lot like simple macroeconomic models, and those have been so wrong about a system that's in some ways less complex than the atmosphere. So I have questions. And the global warming is a kind of state science institute example where it sure seems like the scientists get rewarded if they say that government action is needed, but they don't get rewarded if they don't. And their funding all comes from these government agencies. And what do you know? All the government agencies have the agendas they want to promote. So then you get things like these UN global warming panels where they scaremonger and they go into value territory that they're really not qualified to speak about. And the science isn't always very sound. I will say, however, that it's certainly plausible that human beings could put pollutants in the atmosphere and could cause atmospheric changes. That's certainly possible. It's plausible. And then the question is that good or bad, or what ought to be done about it? if there is a tragedy of the commons happening in the atmosphere, then maybe there'd be some property rights solution to it. In short, I think a lot of heated debate shouldn't be happening. I'll just mention another example of sort of State Science Institute, or all the metallurgical authorities' opinions. Example is the reaction that Bjorn Lomborg, the author of The Skeptical Environmentalist, received from various scientists writing in the various scientific journals, where he was the subject of the most scurrilous attacks, and the most attacks were made on his arguments that didn't properly cite his arguments and weren't put in logical order, but they represented the opinions of scientists. And I've rarely seen a better example of judgment, in which Lomborg's work is almost entirely based on judgment and the marshaling of facts and the careful, dispassionate consideration of the various issues, and his critics, who represent almost nothing but opinion and offer very little in the way of a sustained argument. Sean Colonna writes in, glad you're still here, Sean. Says, to follow up, is there a way of proving that an opinion is an invalid estimate of a fact? For instance, if I am of the opinion that Atlas Shrugged is a terrible work of art because it concretizes the tyranny of the powerful over the weak, isn't this something that can be objectively disproved? This strikes me as an instance of an invalid or wrong opinion. In this sense, isn't it wrong to claim that everybody has the right to their opinion? If you can't back it up with the facts, it seems like you don't have the right to the opinion in question. Well, actually, I think objectivism holds that fundamentally the opinion versus fact distinction is untenable. That insofar as what you're making are claims about reality, and moral claims inclusive are claims about reality, then there's a fact of the matter about it, and the claim is fundamentally factual, and the argument has to be assessed as a factual argument. And so the only distinction that can really be made between opinion, like opinion writing or opinion speaking, and more factual speaking, is just has to do with the level of an abstraction or the degree to which you take it as the writer's purpose to represent, to present all the integrations involved in the conclusion. You know, to that extent, a lot of what I've been saying in this lecture is opinion, in the sense that I'm not in a position to give a detailed answer on why I'm advocating certain points of view, or saying that they're admirable in Dagny. Rather, what I'm saying is I'm trying to call people's attention to the richness that Dagny represents as a model of human living. So I think that it's absolutely true that you should be able to take any piece of opinion and challenge it on the basis of the facts. And even a lot of time when you hear arguments from people, there's a moral element and a non-moral claim of the fact. And you can separate these so that at least if there's a remaining debate, it has to do with the morals, and then you can have a debate about the morals. So I think definitely, in fact, I think dealing with people with whom you disagree, going to the facts and trying to talk about the facts is exactly the right thing to do, because it avoids an immediate conflict over very abstractly held and personally held commitments like politics or morals, and gets into a territory where you can start marshaling the actual argument, which is the facts. All right. And my last question, Richard Kahn, who said he sent in an email to me about seeing future webinars on how to survive in a chaotic economy. But here's the question, Richard says you can ask a question here. Well, I'll email you back on that one, Richard. Okay, let me check if there's anything else I've overlooked. I don't think so. Okay, thank you all. Thanks for taking part. I'm going to close my poll here. And I'm going to go to... my last slide. Oh, I like this one. Dagny loves life. If you have any follow-up questions or suggestions, please email me. I'm hopeful to have a recording of this webinar available online in the future, assuming no technical hiccup. And I'll be back talking about Hank Reardon in this a very similar level of detail in my next webinar, which is next Wednesday, May 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern. Thanks again for taking part. Please support the Atlas Society if the work we're doing is of value to you. It takes resources in order to do this work, and we need all the support we can to keep fighting for reason and the appreciation of human individual achievement. Thank you very much for taking part.